What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. Very excited to be speaking to you. We have a really special show for you today. We are bringing back onto the show, because we cannot get enough of her, Susan Abulhawa, who is, of course, the Palestinian writer and activist. And we're going to be talking to her during the first half of the show. Then we are going to be speaking to Lily Greenberg-Call and Harrison Mann during the second half of the show. Lily was the first Jewish person to resign from the Biden administration over its handling of Gaza. And Harrison was a U.S. Army major who resigned also over Gaza. Before I bring Susan on, though, I just want to remind everyone to please give the stream a thumbs up, because we are really trying to get voices out there that are often censored, maligned, ignored. In the case of tonight, we'll say literally censored. And a good way to do that is by getting the word out, and it helps the algorithm if you give it a thumbs up. Also, please subscribe by hitting subscribe and then the bell. That way you don't miss any streams. And if you have any way that you can support the show, we would love that at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. And for just $1 a month, so that's $12 a year, you help make the show happen. We literally couldn't do the show without Patreon support. And if you can do $5 a month, you get extended interviews and bonus interviews. So I'm really excited to be bringing back onto the show Susan Abulhawa, who is an award-winning Palestinian-American writer, human rights activist, and animal rights advocate. Her first novel, Mornings in Jenin, was translated into 32 languages and sold more than a million copies. She's also the author of The Blue Between Sky and Water, as well as Against a Loveless World, both of which are excellent, as of course is Mornings in Jenin. She is the founder of the NGO Playgrounds for Palestine and also the founder of Palestine Rights, the only North American literature festival dedicated to celebrating and promoting cultural productions of Palestinian writers and artists. Susan has been to Gaza twice since Israel launched its genocidal war on the people of Gaza. So welcome, Susan.
Hi, Katie. It's good to be here.
Oh, great. Well, we are really happy to have you. And because Susan is, as I said, an animal rights advocate, I have to introduce to Susan and to the audience. One second, please.
Floof.
This is Floof. Some of you guys may know Bodie. She's my parents' dog. And this is Floof, who's a rescue. Hold on one second.
Aww.
He's actually very sweet. He's a rescue, and he's a half Brussels Griffin and half Shih Tzu. He's very, very, very sweet. He's a real lap dog, and he has a lot of energy, but he is really sweet, and he is like the cutest little underbite.
All right, so not to be outdone.
Yeah.
This is Luca.
Luca. Say hi, Luca. Luca and Floof, I bet they get along. They're both anti-Zionist dogs, I'm sure.
Of course.
Luca, how old is Luca?
Luca's an old man. He's not too old. He's 8.
Oh, 8. Okay. Yeah, that's not too old. Yeah. He looks good. He looks young. Bodie, my parents' dog, is 15 and looks really young. And we think he's 5. We're not sure, though.
He's adorable. Isn't he so cute? I love the underbite.
I know. It's so cute. And he has very soft, soft, soft hair. Okay, Floof, say goodbye to everyone. This is your debut. You're big time now. All right.
I love that you did that, Katie.
Oh, thank you.
I really do. I think it's really important.
Well, yeah. Watching Israel kill children, women, men, you know, men count too, obviously, although the Western media would like maybe people to think they don't. But, you know, it's all really heartbreaking. And then on top of that, you see them like, I mean, shooting animals. Like I saw that they like shot an animal that had like, carrying like food.
A horse. I just wrote a 5,000 word piece for an anthology about animals in Gaza and what's happening to them. And yeah, they're so I ended up doing a lot of research on the matter. And there's a lot more evidence and footage than I expected of targeting horses. Because there was a whole equestrian club in Gaza that had a lot of, you know, a lot of horses. And they targeted them. They targeted sheep, goats. A horse that was carrying, pulling a cart of flour. They targeted, and then of course, you know, the killing of every, like all of life. Right. And I mean, the disappearance of bugs and insects and birds and, small mammals. I mean, all of these things that are vital to every ecological, formation anywhere. And it's just decimated all of it.
And then on the other hand, you see these people like rescuing. I mean, it's like so heartbreaking and moving too, to see people like go into their houses to rescue dogs and cats. And it's just like, or like trying to make sure that their pets have food and they barely have food. It's just like.
That has been one of the really moving bits is that people who are starving are literally sharing their food with strays and you know there's a few animal rescue organizations in Gaza. One of the most prominent is Sulala, and they're friends of mine, and I talk to them on a more or less regular basis, and they've set up clinics, you know, for injured animals, and I know for a fact that they themselves are food insecure, to say the least, and they don't have a whole lot of supplies. But this is what they're doing. And one of the things they told me too is that and this has surprised them, is that there's actually more people adopting strays. And especially kids. And it's, you know, they're saying that it's almost been like a comfort for the children to care for these animals. And so they're seeing a lot more of that, which is reassuring to me, you know, because all of this trauma, you know, you wonder where that's going to go and how that's going to manifest. So right. I'm very happy to hear that, you know, at least, for some of these children, that it's getting translated into deep compassion.
It's really interesting you brought that up, because as you know, I'm working on this documentary about Jewish Holocaust survivors who are speaking out against the genocide happening now and saying like, not in our name, never again for anyone, never again is now. But I often, when I'm talking about this with the subjects, I think how there are like two ways that people can respond to trauma. And one is, you know, the expression like hurt people, or you have some of the most like compassionate people who, because of their own trauma, their response is not, I'm going to abuse other people or I'm going to traumatize other people. It's like, what can I do to make sure other people aren't traumatized? Mm-hmm. And I bring that up actually as a segue. I mean, I didn't plan to, but you do open up this speech. So let me set this up. So one of the things we're going to be talking about tonight is this really incredible speech that you gave at the Oxford Union. It was a debate, and the debate was about a resolution that was, this House believes that Israel is an apartheid state responsible for genocide. And you obviously argued for it, along with Oxford Union President Ebrahim Osman Mafawi, Palestinian poet and activist Mohammed El-Kurd, and anti-Zionist writer and activist Miko Peled. On the other side, arguing against this was UK Lawyers for Israel Charitable Trust Legal Director Natasha Hausdorff, writer and Oxford alum Jonathan Sesser Dodi, and former Palestinian spy and anti-Hamas activist Mossab Hassan Youssef, and Arab pro-Israel activist Yosef Haddad. So we are going to talk about this speech because for two reasons. One is I actually just wanted to have you on to talk about it because so many people were rightly hailing it as this really incredible speech, which it is. And then on top of that, obviously it was a powerful speech. And we know that because the Oxford Union uploaded the speech. And then after it got, I think, hundreds of thousands of views, took it down and removed only, I think, a total of like a few minutes of content. But I thought it'd be interesting to take a look at what they consider to be such dangerous content from you. So first up, we're going to show just the opening of your speech. And as people will see, it talks about some people who did not, I think, take the right lessons of persecution and trauma in terms of what they did to the people of Palestine. So let's take a look at your opening, and then we'll actually play the censored parts of it.
Before I start, I will not be taking any points of information, so kindly refrain from interrupting me. Addressing the challenge of what to do about the indigenous inhabitants of the land, Chaim Weizmann, a Russian Jew, said to the World Zionist Congress in 1921 that Palestinians were akin to, quote, the rocks of Judea, obstacles that had to be cleared on a difficult path. David Grun, a Polish Jew who changed his name to David Ben-Gurion in order to sound relevant to the region, said, quote, we must expel the Arabs and take their places. There are thousands of such conversations among the early Zionists who plotted and implemented the violent colonization of Palestine and the annihilation of her native people. But they were only partially successful, murdering or ethnically cleansing 80% of the Palestinians, which meant that 20% of us remained, an enduring obstacle to their colonial fantasies, which became the subject of their obsessions in the decades that followed, especially after conquering what remained of Palestine in 1967.
So that was your opening. Anything you want to say about that? Like how did it even occur to you to start there? I thought it was pretty fascinating.
So first of all, let me back up. When they invited me, the reason I decided to go was not really to debate people who, you know, I just don't really care to debate the people who think that we should be killed or, you know, and I said this in part of my speech that talked about the humiliation of debating people who think our only life options should be to leave our homeland, submit to their supremacy, or die quietly and politely. But I decided to go because I have on multiple occasions gone back and listened to the speeches of Malcolm X and Jimmy Baldwin, who spoke at the Oxford Union and the Cambridge Union debates before I was born. And so the historic record mattered to me. And I wrote that speech for the historic record. It's not about winning a debate or anything. I'm not a debater. I don't care what any group of people decides in this moment. But the historic record is important because there will come a day in which future generations are going to study this extraordinary time when the whole world watched a live streamed genocide in the wholeness, in the fullness of its gore and cruelty and mercilessness and horror. And we should keep records of this moment for those who will come after us to study this. And so this was going to be, for me, part of the record. And so I worked a lot on this speech. Mostly the hard part about it was saying everything I wanted to say in less than 15 yeah. minutes, you know? And so I worked on it for days, really, mostly to cut it down and to craft it in my voice, in my literary aesthetic, and craft it for content and for impact and for cadence and for all of these things. And I'm saying this really to underscore the offense of right. having the Oxford Union then go in and edit yeah. it.
Right. So we're going to take a look at what they edited out. Now, it's interesting. They edited like a sentence here, a fragment there. So what we're going to do is we're going to show precisely what they edited out, and then we're going to show it in its like larger context so it makes more sense. So here is the first thing that they removed.
And in the 1980s... And in the 1980s and 90s, Israeli soldiers had left booby-trapped toys in southern Lebanon that exploded when excited children picked them up.
Okay, so... I mean, that is, I think it's probably self-explanatory why they wouldn't want that in there. But what are your thoughts on that? Why that was so threatening to them?
I think my whole speech was threatening to them, honestly. But regardless, that's documented. Right. It's documented in news reports at the time. It's documented in UN reports, in eyewitness testimony, in victim testimony. It's part of the historic record. Right. Of course, yeah, they don't want people to know that. I think if they could have, they would have, you know, just erased my entire speech.
Right. Yeah. Did they suggest beforehand that they had the right to like edit anything out? Did they ever say that? I'm just curious.
The Oxford Union?
Yeah.
So it's interesting because I had a writer, they agreed to that my speech would not be edited at all.
Oh, you had a writer. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I thought you were saying writer. Okay, writer. Oh, got it. Yeah.
A writer, R-I-D-E-R.
Wow.
However, the release that they told me I had to sign because I was told was a formality, and that the writer that they had agreed to would trump everything else. But that release said, you know, sort of gave them the right to edit it for, I think, you know, just aesthetic to sort of excise one speech. There's certainly no indication anywhere that they, nor is there a precedent, actually, that they would edit like my words. I mean, it's right. kind of, to me, especially because I wasn't speaking off the cuff. All the other speakers sort of maybe had notes or something. If they were speaking off the cuffs, they're orators and that's what they do. But I'm a writer and that's what I do. And I read what I wrote because I weighed every sentence. It was a crafted speech.
Yeah.
And so for them to go in and edit that is kind of like somebody taking my books and editing some of my words and then just publishing it without, do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Without even acknowledging it. Right. Like it's not even like this has been edited for length or whatever, like people will sometimes do. Yeah.
Well, that's another thing too, because so first of all, there's this sort of infringement on my intellectual property, my intellectual labor. But there's the offense against the historic record. Like they've fashioned these people who claim to be bastions of free speech and open debate. In fact, made themselves the arbiters of what's acceptable speech and what's not. So that's the other thing. It was just egregious. It was just egregious all around.
And do you know where the pressure came from? I mean, besides the usual suspects, like,
well, I'm guessing it's from lawyers for Israel, because they were making all kinds of noise. So what they did was, first of all, before the debate, they actually kind of were strong arming the Oxford Union into kind of blackmailing them, actually, into allowing Mossab Youssef, who really has no place in the Oxford debates. I mean, nor does Youssef Haddad. I mean, these are not thinkers. They're not, right. they're not academics. They're not writers. Right. They're not politicians. They're just these like angry brutes who yell and scream and they literally have blood on their hands. I mean,
yeah,
like actual literal blood on their hands of people that whose murder they caused or anyway. So, and I think that they knew that we would object to being in a room with them, in part because honestly, like, we weren't there for theater, right? I'm not interested in that. I mean, I'm interested in having an intellectual to be in an intellectual forum where people are going to articulate positions that that are grounded in truth and history. So we initially objected, like, what is it? You know, what are you trying to do? So we went from having Benny Morris, who I don't like, who's really egregious,
right?
But at least
he's a historian.
He's a historian, and he can speak cogently,
right?
And he can articulate a position,
right?
So we
went from Benny Morris, but yeah,
we went from Benny Morris to these, I don't know what to call them, honestly, but they definitely weren't academics. We'll say that.
And just so for people who don't know, one of them is someone who calls himself, I guess, an Israeli Arab, right? That's what he calls himself. And he dates that woman, Emily Schrader, who's just absolutely awful. Some like woman from, I think, California who lives in Israel. Mm-hmm. They, of course, can't get married because they're not both Jewish, so they can't get married in Israel. I forget, is he Muslim or Christian? Do you know?
I really don't know. Yeah, and actually, what's interesting is that he claims to be from Haifa, but nobody, like, we have friends who've actually tried to find out who his people are. And and either nobody's claiming him because...
Right. I wouldn't either, yeah.
Or he actually is not from there and it's a big lie. And
oh, wow, yeah.
So... really nobody knows who this guy actually really is.
Yeah.
But anyway,
and
he
harasses, like, there's video of him harassing like an Orthodox Jew, calling him a traitor because he's an anti-Zionist. Yeah.
He's a little bit unhinged.
He is. Yeah.
And I think in every interaction, and just like he did at the Oxford Union, he just, it's this bellicose and that, sort of kind of rhetoric, and then it turns into anger and shouting and slurs and obscenities. Right. And that's exactly, he had to be removed.
Right.
And then you have Mossab Youssef who is working out his daddy issues. I don't know.
Right. Because his father was a Hamas leader.
Yeah. And his father disowned him. He turned against, he was working, he sort of brags about at one point receiving a salary from Israel, from the United States, from the Mossad and from Hamas from the Palestinian Authority and from Hamas all at once, because he was just sort of so duplicitous and working for everybody. But anyway, right. So the opposing team told the Oxford Union that if they did not allow Mossab Youssef to be on their team, that they would all withdraw and they would go to the media and, you know, make a circus. And so we didn't want the debate to be canceled because that's what would have happened. So we decided to go ahead and kind of call their bluff. And when they were there, I think they were just, it was very clear that their position was indefensible. And there wasn't a whole lot of favor for them in the audience either.
Right.
And so they were just angry. And then as soon as it was over, they went on, before anything was posted, they went on this media blitz, I think, that they had already planned and put in place, which is something Zionists always do in order to own the narrative, whatever.
Get ahead of it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what happened.
Yeah. And Haddad, by the way, of course, bragged about being in the, you know, in the IDF and how great it is to be in the IDF. And that's for him a sign of a lack of apartheid.
Yeah.
So let's actually watch again, because your words are so powerful. Let's watch the context of that booby trap toy clip so people can hear, you know, the context.
When I was in Gaza this year, I saw a little boy no more than 9 years whose hands and part of his face had been blown off by a booby-trapped can of food that soldiers had left behind for Gaza's starving children. I later learned that they also had left poisoned food for people in Shujaiya.
That's bullshit.
And in the 1980s, and 90s, Israeli soldiers had left booby-trapped toys in southern Lebanon that exploded when excited children picked them up.
So they respond, they can't, like, they say that's bullshit, right? In this, like, hall of, you know, intellectual decorum. That's how they respond to your claim, which is true. And then, I mean, it makes sense that people would want that part about, I mean, everything that you're describing is awful, but I think there's something, like, particularly diabolical about booby-trapping toys.
No, yeah, you're right, because it's, like, it's literally intended for children, so
right.
Why else would you booby-trap toys? Yeah.
Right, yeah, it's just so disgusting. And actually, on a related note, I want to ask you, and then we'll watch more clips, but you actually, speaking of casualties, and that's also horrendous what you saw in Gaza. I mean, I can't imagine that, but you are a scientist yourself, and you did, before The Lancet did, you were actually looking at casualties and the death count. Can you talk about how you did that and what you found?
Yeah. So one of the things that was really clear to me when I was in Gaza is how the underestimation of the death toll. Like I recognized that right away, because I saw a lot of people who were dying from chronic conditions because they didn't have any medication. And of course, none of those people were being counted among the martyrs. No people who were, especially children, the ones who were coming in with severe malnutrition and some of whom died, none of them were being counted as martyrs. The only people being counted as martyrs were people who had died by direct fire. And even among those, they would only count the person as a martyr if they were able to identify their full name and their civil ID number. And so some people, even people who were killed by direct fire, if they came in and that information was not available, they didn't get counted. People who were injured, who came in and had operations, whether it was amputations or whatever, the vast majority of them were getting infections and becoming septic, and some of them were dying by sepsis, and they were not being counted. So a lot of people died post-op from infections, because there's no antibiotics and the hospitals are so depleted. So I recognized right away that the massive undercount. And when I was doing the interview for the Al Jazeera documentary that came out on Gaza war crimes, I mentioned in one of my answers, this never made it into the final film, but I said something, I think I said something like, you know, when this is all said and done, I think we're going to find that at least 300,000 Palestinians had been killed. Now, this was months ago. And I just remember the shock on the interviewer's face. It was Richard Sanders from Al Jazeera, Al Jazeera's investigative unit. And he asked me, he said, "You mean death and injuries?" I said, "No, death." And he just looked shocked. And so I was like, you know what? People aren't believing this. I need to, like, show it. And so I did a study. And it was published in the Electronic Intifada. And basically, I mean, it's not difficult to us to come up with these with estimates of death tolls, because we had there's a known mortality and morbidity mortality rates for specific chronic conditions if left untreated, right? There's a percentage of mortality in certain conditions. So we know that. And we also know the number of of people who had these chronic conditions. We also know the number of people who were missing. There are an estimate that data is there. We have a precise count of people who met the conditions that I mentioned before, who were killed by direct fire, were identified by name, and so forth. And also, one can estimate quite easily the death from indirect deaths, and I go through all of that, and I do it very scientifically, and I referenced the relevant literature and scientific literature. And so the final estimate that I came up with, this was back I forget when, it's months ago now, but the final estimate was a range within a certain margin of error. It was 194,000 to 514,000 plus. And that, you know, that included direct and indirect murder by Israel. You know, that's like a quarter of the population on the upper end of that. And of course, nobody, you know, nobody paid me any mind until 10 days later, the Lancet Journal, one of the most prestigious medical journals, published a short sort of estimate. I think it was around 186,000. And actually, the first time I saw it was messaged to me by Richard Sanders, who I think didn't believe me during the interview. He messaged me. And so that coincided with the lower end of the range that I had come up with. I still think, I think that's a massive underestimation, actually, the 186,000. I think it's far, far more than that.
Right. Yeah. It's just awful. But yeah, it's, I mean, and also one of the, I mean, it's just horror upon horror, but knowing that like that more people are dying in part because they don't have the fuel to like lift the collapsed buildings is just another level of horror. Yeah. As is Israel not letting in anesthesia as like a record number, a record ratio, record percentage of children are undergoing amputations.
And a lot of people, you know, you can die from shock too. And so the pain can be so severe that it sends you into like a fatal shock. And that's happened to a lot of people who just, you know, one of the most intense physical pains you can feel is bone pain, like sawing through bones. Like that is, that's like barbaric. That's off the scales pain. And children were going through that, if you can imagine.
No, it's truly unimaginable. Sadism. Yeah. Well, back to your powerful words, let's take a look at another censored piece of your speech. And then again, we'll play the longer clip for context. But this is not surprising at all that it got censored. Let's take a look.
If Palestinians were systematically raping Jewish doctors, patients, and other captives with hot metal rods, jagged and electrified sticks, and fire extinguishers, sometimes raping them to death, as happened with Dr. Adnan al-Bursh and others.
So that, yeah.
But it's true.
Right, I know, yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Which is why, of course, they can't have you say it. And, you know, we've talked about this a lot on the show, how, God forbid, anyone who talks about the mass rape, I put that in quotes, the October 7th mass rape, it would be one thing if they talked about that and then also talked about the documented rape of Palestinians. Like, I could think that they were gullible as opposed to outright lying, but they are outright lying because there's no way that Jake Tapper and Dana Bash don't know about the rape. Because it's not covered by the New York Times. And, you know, in other words, it's not just like Electronic Intifada or Mondo Weiss or the Gray Zone. It's covered by now the New York Times. It's covered by like all Israeli media. And as everyone knows who pays attention to this, you have a Knesset member saying it's legitimate. It's not denied by Israel. So anyone who claims to care about sexual violence, who ignores that, obviously just could not care less about it.
Right.
So
yeah, they all kind of went on this whole media blitz of believe yeah. Israeli women, etc. Except, but don't believe Palestinian women. Don't believe Palestinian men. Right. Don't even believe Israeli rapists who admit to raping.
Right.
You know, don't believe.
Right. Don't believe Israelis yeah. protesting because they're angry at Israeli police for detaining Israeli soldiers for rape.
I think that's kind of an unprecedented yeah. thing in history. I don't think anybody has ever rioted or protested because they felt they had the right to systematically rape yeah. other people.
Yeah, it truly is. I mean, it's almost like if I heard about it in a script, I would say it's like over the top.
Yeah.
Like if it was in a screenplay, right? Like no one will believe that. That's too much. Yeah. But it is. Yeah. So let's take a look at this because this is a very effective part of your speech where you're basically just calling out the stunning hypocrisy and double standards. So let's take a look at the clip that this comes from.
It is clear to me that we are not here to debate whether Israel is an apartheid or genocidal state. This debate is ultimately about the worth of Palestinian lives. It's about the worth of our schools, our research centers, our books, our art. It's about the worth of the homes we worked all our lives to build and which contain memories of generations. It's about the worth of our humanity and our agency, of our bodies and our ambitions. Because if the roles were reversed, if Palestinians had spent the last 8 decades stealing Jewish homes, expelling, oppressing, imprisoning, poisoning, torturing, killing, raping them. If Palestinians had killed an estimated 300,000 Jews in 1 year, targeted their journalists, their thinkers, their healthcare workers, their athletes, their artists, bombed every Israeli hospital, university, library, museum, cultural center, synagogue, and simultaneously set up an observation platform where citizens came to watch their slaughter as if a tourist attraction. If Palestinians had corralled them into by the hundreds of thousands into flimsy tents, bombed them in so-called safe zones, burned them alive, cut off their food and water and medicine. If Palestinians made their children wander barefoot with empty pots, made them gather the flesh of their parents into plastic bags, bury their siblings, their cousins, their friends, made them sneak out from their tents at night to sleep on their parents' graves, made them pray for death. Just to join their families and not be alone in this terrible world. If we terrorize them so utterly that their children lose their hair, lose their memory, lose their minds. And made those as young as 4 and 5 die of heart attacks. If we mercilessly force their NICU babies to die, alone in hospital beds, crying until they could cry no more, died and decomposed in the same spot. If Palestinians used wheat flour, a truck, to lure starving Jews, then opened fire on them as they gathered to collect the day's bread. If Palestinians finally allowed a food delivery into a shelter with hungry Jews, then set fire to the entire shelter and aid truck before anyone could taste a bite of the food. If a Palestinian sniper bragged about blowing out 42 Jewish kneecaps in 1 day, as one Israeli soldier did in 2019, if a Palestinian admitted to CNN that he ran over hundreds of Jews with his tank, their squished flesh lingering in the tank treads. If Palestinians were systematically raping Jewish doctors, patients, and other captives with hot metal rods, jagged and electrified sticks, and fire extinguishers, sometimes raping them to death, as happened with Dr. Adnan Al-Bursh and others. If Jewish women were forced to give birth in filth, get C-sections or leg amputations without anesthesia, if we destroyed their children, then decorated our tanks with their toys, if we killed or displaced their women, then posed in their lingerie, if the world were watching the live-streamed systematic annihilation of Jews in real time, there would be no debating whether that constituted terrorism or genocide.
I mean, I think that, like, the people, like, going back to what I had said earlier in our conversation, this really does, to me, like, bring out, it's such a moral line in the sand, because if you see that and hear about that, I guess I'm saying this as a Jew, but, like, to my fellow Jews, if you hear that or see that and think that, well, that has to happen, as opposed to, we can't do that, how can we possibly do that to other people when that kind of stuff was done to us? It's like a die. I just think you're have no soul. And also, I think you probably would have been a Nazi if you could have been during that time, or a Nazi sympathizer.
I mean, that's the behavior.
Yeah.
That's the behavior they're exhibiting.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. We have, oh, and you know, something interesting, by the way, I wanted to read a part of the James Baldwin, the Jimmy Baldwin speech that you mentioned, because let's see, where is this? Nate just sent this to me. And thank you, Nate, for all the research that you do on the show. Where did you put it? Let's see. Oh, I got it now. Okay. So I'm just going to read you this quote, which is from James Baldwin's speech that you mentioned. Any American Negro watching this, no matter where he is, from the vantage point of Harlem, which is another terrible place, has to say to himself, in spite of what the government says, hyphen, the government says we can't do anything about it, hyphen, but if those were white people being murdered in Mississippi work farms, being carried off to jail, if those were white children running up and down the streets, the government would find some way of doing something about it. Just reminded me of this, of a, you know, comparable indictment of a undeniable double standard.
And sometimes, sadly, people like us have to do that, right? Because
yeah,
we have to say that. We have to make people imagine, like, what if it wasn't us?
Right.
Because we are so dehumanized. There's such an expectation that this is how we are meant to live. Because there, you know, this is decades of conditioning through mass media, through Hollywood, through the publishing industry, through,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that, because I have a friend who, she has our politics, extremely critical of Israel. She's Arab American. And she said to me once, she's like, it's so awful because sometimes I have to check. I have to be like, wait, this is really bad what they're doing, right? And she, to check that it really is she imagines it being done to Jews. Mm-hmm. You know, and she's not self-loathing. She's not quiet about this. She's as like open as you are, you know, but even so, it's like, it's so ingrained. And that is, again, like the whole point of what on earth is the point of historical, like, precedent? The whole point of history is learning from its mistakes, not repeating them. I mean, it's just such a violation of all those people who are killed, like all their memories, to just use that to say, we're going to do something like that to other people.
Isn't that something? Because that's Israel's entire
shtick.
Yeah, that's the crux of their arguments. Well, look what you did in Nagasaki. Look what you did in Hiroshima.
Oh, right, exactly.
To Dresden, you know,
right.
and
exactly.
Native Americans,
right.
Et cetera. Like, this happens in the world, right? Like,
exactly,
I mean, what are they
yeah.
going to say next? Well, look at the Holocaust, you know?
Yeah, exactly,
like,
right.
Waiting for them to say that. They're literally invoking every horrific chapter in human history, not in the context of never again,
exactly.
but as a precedent to emulate.
Right.
Like, that's the, you know, that's the irony.
No, that's really well said. Yeah, they love bringing up the indigenous stuff in the United
yeah.
States, right? And again, it's not because, like, and that's why we shouldn't be doing this. It's like, and that's why it's not a big deal. We got to do it. What about this?
Yeah,
yeah, it's like a total perversion of history. Yeah. And then their other thing is that they say, you know, they don't say it overtly because they don't want to admit that this is a genocide. But of course, the whole premise of Israel is, while they were founded, you know, and like they gave the reparations that Germany gave them. They didn't give them to survivors in Israel. Like they gave it to the government, and they built things with it and worked on their like atomic program with it, which is so sick.
The survivors are like among the poorest of the
poor. Yeah. Right. And they called them soap, like sepon, which is like a reference to the myth. I mean, it's not true, but a reference to like the claim that Nazis turned them into soap. I mean, that's how disdainful they were of them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just awful. Okay. So we have another censored moment of this. And people keep asking, it is fully available, the speech. We're just highlighting the censored parts. And I also want to give a shout out to the person who kind of documented this censorship, like bit by bit. Their Twitter handle is ANONYMOSTW, and we'll put a link to it also. Okay, so let's see. What's next, Brad? What's the next censored part?
These notions of entitlement and privilege, of being divinely favored or blessed or chosen.
Okay, so let's watch the context for this, because this is really powerful also.
House resolution, though well-meaning and appreciated, is of little consequence in the midst of this Holocaust of our time. I came in the spirit of Malcolm X and Jimmy Baldwin, both of whom stood here and in Cambridge before I was born, facing finely dressed, well-spoken monsters who harbored the same supremacist ideologies as Zionism. These notions of entitlement and privilege, of being divinely favored or blessed or chosen.
Yeah. So that's a pretty powerful indictment. And I assume that people don't like to be reminded of them.
They don't want people to make the connections. They don't want people to make to draw the straight line from white supremacy to Zionism.
Exactly.
And there is a straight line, you know?
Yeah. Okay. And then we have one more part. This is the final part that they censored.
There's actually another, there are five, but yeah.
There's five. Okay. Mm-hmm. We only have four, but we'll have to add that other one.
You carved out our hearts, because it is clear that you do not know how to live in the world without dominating others. You have crossed all lines. You have crossed all lines and nurtured the most vile of human impulses.
Okay, and so let's watch the fuller clip for that.
And I also came to speak directly to Zionists here and everywhere. We let you into our homes when your own countries tried to murder you and everyone else turned you away. We fed you and we clothed you. We gave you shelter and we shared from the bounty of our land with you. And when the time was ripe, you kicked us out of our homes and homeland. Then you killed and robbed and burned and looted our lives. You carved out our hearts, because it is clear that you do not know how to live in the world without dominating others. You have crossed all lines. You have crossed all lines and nurtured the most vile of human impulses. But the world is finally glimpsing the terror we have endured at your hands for so long. And they are seeing the reality of who you are and who you've always been. They watch in utter astonishment the sadism, the glee, the joy, and the pleasure with which you conduct, watch, and cheer the daily details of breaking our bodies, our minds, our future, and our past.
That's, I mean, also understandable that they would want that cut. Because again, I mean, not only is it such a harsh indictment, but I'm going to say the way you read it is also just very effective.
And I think, but and so part of the, like I said, I think that they would have been happy for most of the speech to be deleted, or all of it. But the problem too, and part of the harm, is that the Oxford Union put out a statement insinuating that they edited it because of for legal issues. Like I had, as if I had said something that was illegal or I don't know, or right. something so egregious, or you know what I mean, that it would that would constitute a legal challenge
and get them in trouble. Allegedly, that's their mm-hmm. claim.
Yeah,
okay, yeah. And I believe we have the last piece that was censored, right, Brad? Do you have that? Yeah, he's doing that. You know, another thing, by the way, is that we had I interviewed Chaim Breshith the other day, who, of course, was arrested, the 79-year-old son of Holocaust survivors, mm-hmm. who's a very outspoken critic of Israel, who was arrested for saying that Israel was not going to be able to defeat Hamas or Hezbollah. And that is a crime. Like in England, they consider that pro-terrorism speech. And then Miko Peled said something yeah. during the debate, and he is getting, they're trying to get him in trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he said something that I think he called, he said Hamas or the people on October 7th were not terrorists, but freedom fighters. And that, I guess, is also considered what?
Yeah.
Under the terrorism laws, that's also illegal?
Apparently, yeah. It's incredible. And so they actually stopped his speech at that point, and they gave the president a challenge. Saying that this is, you know, under blah, blah, blah code, right. that this is illegal. And I think the president at the time said, you know, like, we're not the police. This isn't,
right.
you know, anyway. And Miko continued. But of course, they embargoed his speech for legal liability.
Right.
But it is really incredible that there is such a law that, you know what I mean? So, so basically, if you don't think the way the government thinks, you go to jail. Like, that's incredible. Right. This is supposed to be a democracy. And you see how quickly they oscillate, you know, how many, you know, people they put on the terrorist list and they take them off. HTS one day is a terrorist organization. And now they're their darlings. One day they're, you know, chopping off heads, and now they're, I don't know,
freedom
heroes.
Fighters. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, on the other hand too, you had the ANC and people like,
that's exactly what I was going to say. Right.
Nelson Mandela yeah. and who were on the terrorist list. You know what
right.
I mean?
So in the, under this law, I guess if you had said something good about Mandela, you would have been breaking the law also criminal. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have they responded to you? The Oxford Union?
So, I have not been contacted by the president of the union, which is really disappointing, but I have spoken with some of the existing staff and the previous president. And so initially they called to tell me that, hey, you know, we're sorry, but we have to do this for legal reasons. And I said, hold up. You know, I don't know what you think, on what planet you think this is okay, or if you think I'm going to just like be okay with that, you're really mistaken. And I brought the writer to their attention, our previous communication. Right. I brought the fact to their attention, the fact that, you know, they've had, you know, really egregious people, actual convicted criminals, truly racist people, the UK ambassador who calls the Israeli ambassador in the UK, whose calls for genocide were so explicit and overt and egregious that there, you know, it prompted calls for her expulsion from the UK. So those are all people that, you know, went and spoke at, and they, you know, were given a platform at the Oxford Union. And frankly, I don't really care. You know, like, this is like, let the people be the arbiters
right,
of what they want. I think it's great. Let them talk. I don't really care. But I say that just to highlight the fact that they censored me. They censored a member of a society that's literally being wiped off the map, that is currently being annihilated in full view of the world. And they're policing my speech. And it is unprecedented. They have never done this, as far as I know, in any other debate. And if you can imagine, like, during when Malcolm X gave his speech, I'm sure there were white supremacists who objected. And can you imagine if somebody then edited that speech that we all now go back and listen to? I mean, it's a real crime against the historic record, and which is really, like I said, it's really important to me as a student of history to have an intact record to go back to.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. It's like a stealth edit, which is like so dangerous. It's when you know, like you're supposed to, when you edit, you're supposed to acknowledge it at the bottom, right? And you say, you know, this has been update, whatever, but this is pretty sneaky. Now we have, I want to show two more things. And then let's see, I wanted to give the opposite team a chance to make their really convincing point. So this is the, what does he call himself? The, I guess he's also a born again Christian, the son of the Hamas, the disowned son of the Hamas leader.
Yeah, Yusuf, yeah.
Yes. So here's his really effective point that he made on the other side.
Now, there come the Palestinians, the most pathetic people on planet Earth.
And it's what's amazing about that statement is that that was actually tweeted out by someone like a Zionist, a white South African, by the way, but tweeted out as if that was like a good piece of evidence. Like just a bigoted, like self-loathing or however you want to describe it thing. That's like, it's just such an embarrassing piece of non-debate.
So what's interesting when that happened is that somebody stood up in the audience and said, you know, they called for a point of order that they want the speaker expelled because they're literally attacking somebody's identity.
Right.
And the, you know, there was an initial ruling by the president to go along with that, which I didn't really agree with. I'm of the mind to like, let them speak because they just hang themselves with their own words. But in opposition, in sort of arguing to allow him to continue, Natasha Hausdorff stood up and said, you know, this is a man who is speaking about his own people. He's describing his own people. What's the problem?
Wow. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Like, can you imagine, like, if Miko had gotten up and said,
exactly,
you know, and then recounted like terrible Jewish tropes and said, you know, Jews are blah, 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 blah.
Right. But he's Jewish, so it's okay. Right. Would and they already call him a self-loathing Jew just for criticizing Israel.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. But
yeah. And an anti-Semite. Yeah.
So like, yeah. Anyway.
Well, I want to show one final video because you brought up Nelson Mandela and the ANC and how they were, of course, considered terrorists. And of course, Nelson Mandela spoke out against Israel. So here's a clip of Mandela. I believe this is in Nate. Is this actually in Gaza where this video is coming from? Or yeah, this is from Gaza, right? In 1999. Okay, let's take a look.
Choose peace rather than confrontation, except in cases where we cannot get, where we cannot proceed, where we cannot move forward. Then, if the only alternative is violence, we will use violence.
His comments won him applause from leader Yasser Arafat and the assembly. Many Palestinians.
Okay, so that's not in Gaza. That must have been he visited Gaza.
Walls throughout Gaza. Others say our dreams will come true through your support. Pupils at the Shati refugee school waited for hours to greet him.
When he arrived, oh, I guess it was
Gaza. Yeah, that's in Gaza.
Oh, it was in Gaza. Okay.
Inside a cramped classroom, Mandela received more affection. Students greeted him with a song in English. Good morning. We're happy to hear you. The trip to Gaza concludes Mandela's visit to the region, where for the first time he's been trying his hand at Middle East peace diplomacy.
Wow.
Oh, that's such nostalgia. What a beautiful soul.
Well, Susan, any final words? Because you've, as always, been so generous with your time and your thoughts and your insights.
Thank you. I feel like I've taken more time than was allotted to me. So I know you have other guests.
Yeah. Yeah. We do, but this was great also. So
thanks for
having everyone's grateful.
So I'm going to stay on and listen to them.
Great. Thank you so much, Susan. Thanks, and excited to talk to you next time you're on. I want to ask you about your latest writing.
Inshallah.
Project. Okay. Bye. Okay, everyone. That was so great. Always love speaking with Susan. And make sure if you haven't already, give this a thumbs up, not because I'm like, you know, an egomaniac or something or insecure. It's because it actually just really helps with the algorithm. And again, we really want to make sure that we get these stories out there, both the stories of Susan and the words of Susan, the censorship of Susan, and also the voices of the next guests who I'm about to bring on. And those guests are Lily Greenberg Call, who is a former special assistant to the chief of staff at the Department of Interior. She became the first Jewish political appointee to resign in protest of U.S. policy in Gaza. We're also bringing on Harrison Mann, who is a senior fellow at Win Without War and a former U.S. Army major and executive officer of the Defense Intelligence Agency Middle East Africa Regional Center, who also resigned in protest of his office's support for Israel during its Gaza campaign. So welcome, Lily and Harrison. Thank you so much for joining.
Hey there.
Hi.
Nothing else.
Of course, yeah. So before we jump into talking about what's happening right now and what made you, each of you, bravely resign, can you just explain what your kind of jobs were, what your function within the government and the army were?
Yeah, I'm happy to start. So I was, as you mentioned, a political appointee, which, you know, there's two types of roles within the federal government. There's civil servants who stay on regardless of who the administration is. And then there's political appointees who are hired directly by the White House, so the Office of Presidential Personnel. And it's everything from the president's cabinet to you know, there's about 4,000 political appointee roles across government. So it's everyone who's going to lose their job on January 20th. I had worked on the Kamala Harris primary campaign when she was running in 2019, then later joined what would become the Biden campaign in Arizona. So I worked on the campaign, and then that is how I ended up joining the administration and getting hired as an appointee. I was the special assistant to the chief of staff at the Department of Interior. So basically my role was managing the chief of staff and the secretary. I had a very, you know, had a lot of proximity in that role, was really the like most senior of the junior level appointees, next to the secretary special assistant, and had this real kind of bird's eye view of what it's like to run one of the largest federal agencies.
Mm. And what does the Department of Interior really, I mean, sorry to ask such a basic question, okay, but I'll just admit it. Like, I don't honestly, yeah. Can you, for those out there who don't know, unlike me, what's in 30 seconds, what does it do?
So fair. We actually, or we used to call it the Department of Everything Else. So Interior is the home to the National Park Service, the Bureau of Land Management, Bureau, like minerals, gas, oil, ocean energy, wind, Fish and Wildlife Service, and also anything that has to do with Indigenous people and the U.S. government relationship with them. So, you know, Indian Health and Human Services, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Education, et cetera.
Got it. Great. And what about you, Harrison?
Yeah, so I was a career Army officer. When I resigned, I was still in uniform, but I was working at a civilian intelligence agency called the Defense Intelligence Agency, or the DIA. Performs a lot of the same functions as the CIA, which is much more famous, but it's smaller, and it mainly serves the Department of Defense. So if you to get an idea of what my office did, when you hear about the president receiving his presidential daily brief that's telling him what's going on in the world, that's the work of hundreds, if not thousands, of people researching, writing, reading classified intel reporting. My office worked on that for the Middle East and Africa. And part of that is intel sharing with allies and partners both around the world and in the region. So one of the things that my office also did, especially after October 7th, was responsible for sharing a lot of intelligence with the Israeli Ministry of Defense.
Wow. Okay. So I'm going to ask each of you this question. We'll go back to you, Lily, and then to you, Harrison. So when was the first time, Lily, that you really thought, I may have to resign, or if not, I may have to resign? When was the first time you became uncomfortable with what the administration was doing?
I was uncomfortable from, you know, October 10th, or I think whenever it became, it was clear to me very quickly that the, you know, I was under no illusions about what the U.S.-Israel relationship was when I joined the administration. I, before I you know, had my own transformation and started doing work in my personal capacity with groups like If Not Now, another like Jewish anti-occupation organizing. I had done work as a student with AIPAC for years. So I was very like familiar. I know that, you know, Israel's our ally and I know the way this works. I was a little surprised by the intensity of like Biden himself's Zionism and
which he reminded us of like frequently. Yeah.
Yes. Well, and also, I mean, October 7th was, you know, really like it hit my community very hard. There were people that I know who were killed, and many, many people that I know and I'm close to either lost people or have folks who were taken hostage. And so I was, you know, we were like reeling from that. And then it became very clear within, I don't know, 2 or 3 days that Israel's response. I mean, I knew immediately. The second thing I thought about really after finding out that people were killed was like, oh my God, this is going to be the worst thing ever. And I don't know what that's going to be yet, but like, I can't even think about it. And then it became, you know, very clear with Israel's response. And then the United States just refusal to even like, yeah, the refusal to acknowledge Palestinian humanity and also that, you know, that a revenge campaign is like not an effective way to, is not a response, a moral and ethical response to October 7th became very clear, I think, within the first like 2 weeks. So I was already disappointed and frustrated and angry with the administration, and also felt, I think in particular, you know, like there were a lot of, especially non-Jewish people in leadership in the administration trying to tell me that this was because they cared about my family and my community's safety and my friends who were dead, and that this was like what was the best thing to do for them. And I was like, how dare you? How dare you tell me that? I think, you know, I didn't resign until May. And a big part of that was I somewhat naively maybe thought that I could do something from the inside. You know, I wasn't working on this issue in any way, but I am Jewish. I was a political appointee. I felt uniquely kind of privileged to speak out within the administration more so than a lot of my other colleagues who were Muslim or Palestinian or just non-white, and felt very, very censored. So I was being very, very honest and also doing a lot of work to kind of internally try and organize people. And there was widespread dissent across appointees in the administration. It was very, very clear. And the environment was incredibly toxic, both in the admin and on the Hill. And so I spent a lot of months trying to, I was like, what's the point of all this proximity to power if I can't, like, if I can get into a room at the White House and talk to senior people in the administration, I might as well use that and try and do something with that. Obviously, you know, things just continued to get worse and worse and worse. And eventually it became clear to me that I would have potentially a lot more impact by leaving. And I also felt like I had to leave for myself at a certain point.
And did you get into those meetings with high up people? Did those even happen?
There were some. There were some, yeah. And I didn't make a lot of friends.
Right.
But, you know, I think there was also a certain point where it kind of became clear to me that I was tanking certain like career options, especially once people started talking about like what would happen after the election, because everyone assumed we were going to win. And I was kind of like, I think we're all being a little silly here because look what's happening on the streets. They're calling you Genocide Joe.
Right.
Doesn't really feel like good vibes for the election. But, you know, it just like people were starting to talk about that. And I think I very much could have had opportunities to like move up in certain ways. And I saw people who were also like feeling really angry about Gaza, making choices to be quiet about that. And I just was like, I can't do that. If that's what I have to do in this world, that's not for me.
Right. And when you did get into those meetings, what kind of people, I mean, we'd love to know who you spoke to, but if you don't feel comfortable with that, like what kind of people were you speaking to? What was your argument and what was the response?
I mean, there were so some of the things I can share, but I mean, I wouldn't, but they were actually like Politico, I think, reported on these immediately. There were a few listening sessions that were held for appointees in October for, they like separated people in the beginning, Jewish appointees, and then there was one for like all the brown people, basically Palestinians, Arab, Muslim, Christian, you know, for impacted communities. And then they did have some ones jointly, which both groups had expressed a little bit of, you know, frustration. And that was something that I felt really frustrated too by. There were so many people that I worked with who couldn't understand that someone like me was like really upset about what's happening to Palestinians. And I was like, you realize, like, I know Palestinians, like I have been there and spent time there. And like, even if I didn't have the politics that I do, like, I don't know. It just felt so, the fact that people really assumed that our communities are so separate monolithic. And like, can't possibly, monolithic, but also like have never been exposed to each other and don't care about each other is just like really far from my own truth and also experience of like a lot of people that I know.
Well, it's one of the, that's one of the effects, right, of Israel claiming to act on in the name of all of us, right?
Right. Yeah. So there was, I mean, there was senior, you know, White House there, Doug Emhoff went to some of these, Anita Dunn, who's a senior advisor, you know, John Finer, the folks who ran PPO, like, it was senior leadership. You know, I think I was very honest in all of them. And honest that I did not feel that the administration's policies were keeping me safe or keeping my loved ones safe. People did not want to talk about the fact that the root cause of all of this is continued U.S. support for Israeli apartheid and occupation. And that made people very, very uncomfortable. But again, it's something that I felt like uniquely privileged to be able to say without repercussions. I mean, I was like, if you want to fire me or like make my life miserable for saying this, like, do it. But again, no one could say that I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm Jewish. I have spent my whole life in Jewish institutions. I, you know, have spent a lot of time in Israel and Palestine. And if anything, I know like both sides of the argument, if we want to say it like that, even though that's, you know, a stupid way of framing this. I just was like, I'm kind of unimpeachable on this. And I think it became very clear to me, like not right away necessarily, but that was a source of power and that scared people. And I think that is like something that I eventually was like, used to fuel the decision to resign. I didn't like realize that right away. Cause it's hard to turn that on its head and be like, I actually like have more power than these people do in a certain way.
And what do you mean by that?
Like, I just to realize that, I mean, I was very much like called and labeled a troublemaker and like attempt, you know, there was like attempts to like, to realize that people, senior advisors to the president, were scared about what I was saying to other people is power. I mean, that is a form of power.
And that's because you're Jewish and have these like,
because they can't
whatever,
tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about and that I don't care about and that I'm anti-Semitic and that I don't care about Jews and Jewish safety and all that stuff. Like none of it holds any water. And it doesn't when Palestinians say it, but like, they can say that it does.
Yes, you have. Yeah, right. And what about you, Harrison? How did your decision to resign come about?
Yeah, and I should have mentioned when I was explaining what my agency did, my role there was the assistant to a senior official who was in charge of all that analysis for the Middle East and for Africa. And I'm mentioning that because I had a higher vantage point than some of my colleagues about what was going on at the Director of National Intelligence level, at the Department of Defense level, and then also at the NSC level. Anybody doing strategic intelligence is going to get reflections of what those people want and what they're thinking of. I had an especially strong vantage point because of the office that I was in. And so after October 7th, seeing all the same awful stuff in the media and online that y'all were seeing and the horrific images, just kind of what we expected Israel to do after a really surprising, horrific attack. And so I was disturbed by that. But then what I also could see was how the bureaucracy was reacting, how the DoD was reacting, and to a certain extent, how the NSC was reacting. And I was really looking for any indication that the administration was going to put its foot down or was going to moderate or attenuate the level of support we were giving to Israel, because of course you saw the president say it out loud shortly after October 7th, and we felt it in the institutions, in the DOD, in the intel community, that we were going to do a full court press and provide enhanced levels of support to our Israeli counterparts. I think that probably applied to the entire U.S. government, certainly in the IC. So I was really waiting to see if there was going to be any indication from any of this higher leadership that, because of the, you know, at the time, you could most generously describe it as carelessness on the other spectrum, you know, genocidal nature of even just Israel's air campaign in the first couple of weeks after October 7th, that was clearly killing tons of people. And the U.S. government was well aware of the level of destruction and pretty well aware of the level of casualties that was not disputed. So I was really waiting to see, okay, are we going to do anything about this? Are we going to stop meeting with them all the time? Are we going to stop sharing all this intel with them? And that moment never came. And not only did it never come, eventually, and still in October of 2023, we got guidance from DOD and DNI that was clearly intended to respond to concerns that, hey, are we going to be intel sharing with people doing war crimes or gross violations of human rights? Like that was clearly the objective of this guidance. And it basically concluded, if your Israeli counterparts tell you that they're not doing war crimes, they're not, and we're not going to investigate it further. And so that was pretty depressing, I think, for so many other reasons, cultural reasons and my own fear. I never would have really was not planning on doing a lot of challenges internally, but that already showed me there was no point, because we were getting from my boss's boss's boss, an explanation that we're gonna take the Israelis at their word and not push back. And so at that point, I was pretty hopeless, and I understood that, you know, this was not going to let up. And so I was going to be contributing to the slaughter and the killing there as long as I was in my seat. And so submitted my resignation. If you do it in the Army, it's a very slow process. So I didn't get out until several months later. But that basically is what got me started.
Was there something in particular that you saw, like, that was done with either direct or indirect, maybe like implicit support of the U.S. that what made it hard for you to like sleep at night?
I don't know. I mean, the explicit support was, of course, the encouragement of the administration and the fact that we were freely giving them arms and intel no matter what. I think it was surprising to me, and one of the indicators that, okay, we're not really going to care what they do in Gaza. You may remember, this is a quainter world, but last October, it was a really huge deal that the IDF was going to storm or attack. It was a really big deal when it looked like the IDF bombed a large hospital in Gaza. And there was a big deal about that. And then, you know, afterwards, nobody really cared when they bombed other hospitals in times where there's no dispute about it.
Right.
And nobody really cared when it was quite clear that we had advance notice that they were going to attack or target hospitals in some way.
Right.
So that was tough. And, you know, I had a couple months where I was like, oh, wow, this is really going to cross the line.
Yeah.
Never did.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you guys so much. Have a great night.
Thanks, Katie.
Bye.
Thanks.
Don't go anywhere yet, because we have a surprise third act. We have some good news. We're doing a little segment. We'll call it "And Now for Some Good News." I just made that up off the top of my head. But everyone watching, make sure you like. Please like this the stream. Please give it a thumbs up. Please subscribe if you're not already a subscriber. We are going to bring on right now Carrie Gleason, who is a longtime organizer and parent living in Flatbush, Brooklyn. And she's going to talk about some very exciting news involving Floyd Bennett Shelter, which is a massive shelter on the edge of Queens, New York, that houses 2,000 plus asylum seekers. I'm just going to bring on Carrie so she can tell us the latest, because there's an announcement and also a call for support. So welcome, Carrie Gleason.
Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So please tell people who don't know anything about this, what it is and what just happened and what they can do to support.
Yeah, definitely. So Floyd Bennett Field, our federal lands, they're park lands that about a year ago, Mayor Adams administration decided to put up four large tents to house families, hundreds of families. The majority of the people there are kids. It's a flood zone. It's never been a place for families. And I became involved because all of a sudden, about a year ago, dozens of new kids started to arrive at my son's school. And we welcomed these families into our community. And it was really apparent that it was like never a place anyone should live where they were living. We built relationships, Floyd Bennett Field neighbors formed to provide support, humanize the welcoming of these families. And then when Trump won, we realized how vulnerable these families were to Trump's attacks. He declared day one, he's going to start his mass deportation system. He doesn't care if some citizens get wrapped up in it. And we knew that in a sanctuary city like New York City, the families at Floyd Bennett Field were extremely vulnerable. And so our mutual aid turned into a campaign with the residents to call for the families to be relocated safely to other shelters. We did not know if we could win because Adams, we know, is not feeling particularly accountable to communities in New York City at this moment. But somehow a week ago, we were successful and they announced that they were going to be closing the Floyd Bennett Field shelter by mid-January. And already we know families that have been relocated.
Great. So what does that mean? I mean, that's good, obviously, news, right? But then the question is, oh, well, these people are in shelters. So now what do they do?
Yeah, it's a tough situation. It's like, and the process they have to go through to transfer shelters, we should talk about because it's been a mess. We are organizing for the families to be relocated into shelters that are run by the Department of Homeless Services. When we had thousands of new people arrive about a year ago, they created a two-tier system. And so many families are being moved to these emergency shelters that are congregate living for families, which is not good. Ironically, it's run by health and hospitals, despite the fact that we know congregate settings of living are not good for health. And what we really want is for people to be moved like any unhoused New Yorker into a regular shelter. What families really want is to keep their kids in the schools where their kids are thriving. And it's been tougher than we anticipated.
Right. And congregate living is what? What does that mean?
So it's like, it's a big, big room that gets subdivided into like little cubicles where the families live.
Right. And I'm going to ask the question that I'm sure you always hear, right? Which is, I'm being devil's advocate, not even devil's advocate, because I think needs to be addressed. It's like, well, how can we afford that? Where are they going to go? You know, the what's your response to kind of those cliched things that from some people are just powerful people who are just evil. And then I think what's dangerous about it, though, is that it actually lands on people who aren't necessarily that political or evil, but they hear it and it sounds kind of like common sense, which is why I think it's important to dispel it.
Yeah, I mean, our governments make choices about money, right? So right. How can we possibly afford all that money to Israel and not manage to find a bed for a toddler in Brooklyn, New York, which is a very wealthy place that has many, many empty buildings, right? And so they actually have a lot of money in the city. They've put billions of dollars into this process, money that they already had. Adams was sitting on $6 billion that he just wasn't letting to be allocated to schools, to libraries long before any of these lovely families arrived. And they are not doing the most cost-effective thing. So I know families in Brooklyn that are like renting for, you know, anywhere from $2,500 to $4,000 a month. Not affordable. These families are working or looking for places to live. Guess how much they're spending per person at Floyd Bennett Field?
How much?
$383 per person. Per night.
Wow.
Per night. Wow. So this is like $11,000 a month per person. Yeah, like amazing. Like you can live in the penthouse for what they're spending on people. Right. So it's a choice. Like they have money, but they refuse to give families housing in this, to support families in housing. And that's to say families are desperate to get out of the shelter system. They're looking for housing, but New York City has had a housing crisis like long before any of the asylum seekers have arrived. And it's a problem that all New Yorkers are facing. And like, it's something we need to address, but it's not, we absolutely have the space for these families. Like, for example, my son's school in Brooklyn was under-enrolled. He's been there since kindergarten. He just graduated last year. It was always under-enrolled. We were losing funding. And it was only last year when all of these great kids arrived that we were fully enrolled.
Right.
So I just, we have the space. It's just that we're making choices.
Yeah. And how can people support what's happening right now? Because I know people are moving out, but I think they need some supplies. This is, I guess, for people who are in the New York area.
Yeah. So right now, families have to relocate. They get just a day's notice to pack up all their belongings, walk a half a mile to a bus stop, go from the bus stop to a train to Roosevelt Hotel to wait all day, and then maybe in the middle of the night get transferred to a shelter with all of their belongings. What we really need is help. We need help potentially helping people move their stuff from one shelter to the next. And we also have been giving out hundreds and hundreds of suitcases. This whole relocation process is expensive. And so we're asking for donations at Floyd Bennett Field Neighbors. It's, I think it's in the comment.
Yeah. We will put it. It's in the YouTube description now, right, Brad? Yeah. Brad, tell me it was. Yeah. Great.
Thank you.
Oh, and there it is. Okay. Fundraising. So fbfneighbors.org, also in YouTube description. Great. Yeah. Any final words that you want to share? And thanks for all the work you guys are doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think this has been a phenomenal effort of asylum seekers and neighbors that are organizing to protect our sanctuary city. And so it's these types of fights. This was a battle against Trumpism. And it's these types of fights that are going to build the organizing infrastructure that we need for the next few years. And we know that, you know, our sanctuary city status is threatened right now with Adam saying he wants to pass an executive order to override that. And, you know, we need to come together and say that's not who we are.
Right. Yeah. And the Democrats really need to do a better job. They can't just be slightly less draconian and evil than Republicans. Like, that can't be their answer to immigration.
No, not at all. And yeah, the truth is the majority of the city council are like, yes, bring new families. Our communities need to thrive. And it's really the Adams administration not in alignment with the rest of the New Yorkers.
Right. Yeah. Get in line, Adams. Get in line. All right. Well, thank you so much, Carrie, and have a great night.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.